Hello and welcome to another episode of the Rethink Energy podcast, where the Rethink Energy team talk about the technology behind this week's energy news. I'm your returning host, Connor Watts. I'm our battery and automotive analyst, and I am joined yet again by our solar analyst, Andrew Swantonut.
Hello!
While our hydrogen analyst and editor, Bogdan Avramuta, is currently absent due to prior engagements. Now, in this week's episode of the podcast, we're going to be talking about how a Chinese solar manufacturer has cut wafer sizes even further. And while this isn't a massive gain, every little gain in the solar industry is increasingly important due to fierce competition in China. And then we're going to talk about how a new report is claiming that Chinese-made electric vehicles will be increasing their market share within Europe from 19.5% last year to 25% this year, and what this means for European manufacturers, whether this trend's going to continue, etc. So, without much more rattling on, Andreas, can you explain to us this new little innovation and how exactly it works, which is in a free article to read, actually, and it's very technical, so an interesting one.
Yes, it's not actually quite technical enough because I go into the thickness of the wafer and how when you make it thinner, you don't have to use as much polysilicon, which is nice, and things like that. But I would like to write more in future about what sort of cell this gets turned into, probably heterojunction. But we just don't have any information on that. Since this company, Huamin Technologies, is still a bit new, it only reached 50 microns thickness in December, now down to 40 microns. So the norm before the pandemic, before the polysilicon shortage, was to have 170 microns of thickness on your solar wafers, and that's thickness of polysilicon. So all you have to do is add in a little bit of extra thickness for the diamond wire that cuts the ingots into wafers, which is that was about 40 microns as well of total usage per layer of wafers. And then you also have kerf losses when you get rid of the micro cracks from the cutting process. So that would be another 15 microns. So 170 microns in the wafer itself would be about 225 microns of usage. But now we're looking at 40 microns of the wafer itself, and they're almost, I would have to assume that they're using the rather newfangled tungsten cutting wires, which it would be 30 microns or less. Actually, I'm sure I've seen 28 microns, and it's probably less now, and maybe only 10 microns of kerf losses. So what that means is, I mean, all the numbers are probably best consumed in the article themselves, but the final conclusion when you crunch all the numbers is that even at the current low price of polysilicon, which is $7 per kilogram, Huamin Technologies is saving what's the number? $10 per kilowatt, which is actually 10% of the current module cost. And that's compared to the 140 micron mainstream in the industry today. So that maybe doesn't sound too dramatic. Like if you're a rooftop installer, it barely moves the needle. If you're a utility scale developer, I'm sure that would knock several percentage points off your total costs. So actually, that is quite nice. But I think the real story here is that finally we see something interesting from this constant involution. It's the Chinese term involution or neizhuan, I can't pronounce that, where they're painfully chasing small incremental improvements. Because what we have in China's manufacturing industry is 1,000 gigawatts of production capacity, and global demand is only 500 gigawatts. It'll grow to 600 gigawatts in a year, I guess. Or it might even be there, and then it'll grow to 700 gigawatts. But the point is, that means the price has come down to just above the marginal cost of production, or maybe just below, depending on which company you are. And basically, if there's twofold overcapacity, you have to be in the 50% of companies that are the most cost efficient, or you just go out of business because you can't sell. And that's why this kind of thing is happening, as well as a lot of other less dramatic things. So I'm glad that finally we got something mildly dramatic instead of an extra 0.4% of efficiency from such and such back contacts design process. Anyway.
Well, I know that's a massive reduction, isn't it? A 10% reduction in cell cost, you said, correct?
Module cost, actually.
Module cost, even higher. Oh, God. Okay. So, yeah, on a utility scale, that's going to be pretty significant cost savings as that's passed down to the consumer, because as you can say, it having a lower cost of production means it can undercut its other competitors with lower kind of wholesale pricing, as it were. But what does this mean for polysilicon as a supply chain bottleneck? You've been quite firm in that overcapacity is going to last a good few more years minimum.
Oh, well, actually, so a good few decades.
With this is a significant reduction, isn't it? A good few decades now, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah.
Is that assuming this is adopted? Widespread throughout the industry.
Well, for starters, we already have like 1,000 gigawatts worth of polysilicon, and they still had a fair number of new facilities set to come online because it takes 2 years to build them. So if you've already half built it by the time the price drops, you might as well finish it at that point. You've already spent most of the money, sadly.
That's a bit of a sunk cost fallacy, is it not? Well, OPEX costs, yeah, surely.
Yeah.
As opposed to just it being purely CapEx and such.
Yeah, yeah, true. But, you know, if you've already spent most
it's
of
China,
it...
It's China, they might as well...
Yeah, and it's the Chinese. And it's the Chinese. They think it's a good thing. So as to why the polysilicon glut, not shortage, it's now a glut, as of late 2023, will last for decades. Well, because firstly, there's just 1,000 gigawatts and growing slightly. Secondly, yes, we did expect. I wrote this solar module supply chain forecast where I forecast the wafer thickness going down to 60 microns by 2040, and that might still actually be accurate because this is very much an outlier. And I also forecast by like 2030, then. I think it was TOPCon would go down to 110 microns and heterojunction would go down to 90 microns. Those are two cell technologies. And that might still be true. Like, I don't know if this Huamin thing will actually pan out because they might find that because it's only 40 microns thick, it's a pain in the ass to actually move it around without breaking it. Sorry if that sounds a bit fatuous, but it really is like that.
Yeah, it's an interesting problem to have in the sense that, yeah, you've got this massive kind of raw material cost reduction, but it's going to introduce additional complications. How familiar are you with the difference between, because you mentioned the change from the diamond cutting wire to a tungsten cutting wire and that shaving off less?
They're both diamond coated, I think. I think it's steel to tungsten. Sorry, just to be clear.
Steel to tungsten. Oh, I see. Right. So it's a diamond coated steel cutting wire versus a diamond coated tungsten.
Yes.
Cutting wire. I'd be curious how that changes cost.
Well, actually, I'm pretty sure the tungsten is more expensive.
Well, yes, that I'd assume that. But
so
I mean,
it's just barely worth adopting, and I think it gets adopted very, very gradually, that tungsten, because of that. So I don't think this necessarily, I certainly, when I said that, 60 microns in 2040 for the average of the industry, I certainly wasn't expecting a company to already publish 40 microns now, but I might not actually have to change that forecast.
Yeah, but with the low cost, with the relatively low cost intensity and the low, I'm losing the word for it at the moment, but with how polysilicon's no longer the single largest cost factor, or it maybe it is, you would need to tell me, but it's a much less significant cost factor than it used to be a year or two ago anyways. There's going to be less impetus to invest in the necessary manufacturing equipment to bring it all the way down to 60 microns or the 40 microns even.
Yeah, there is less incentive in absolute terms. The cost changes are not that great, but that's where the whole concept of involution and overcapacity comes in because, you have to be the 50% most efficient to survive.
It's the largest and most recent cost reduction.
Oh, and I guess we should mention the further price decline in polysilicon this week. I mean, unless we just measured it at particularly outrageous moments, it seems to have gone down by 7% in the last week, or 12% for the N-type category, which is just the same polysilicon but a bit more pure, so it gets used in the best categories of cell technology. And that's pretty obvious why it would fall, especially for N-type. It's because of the N-type grade polysilicon factories coming online. So polysilicon in general gets even more overcapacity, N-type specifically. So that explains that. Just a bit of context.
I'm slightly curious as to what the margins are getting to with regards to polysilicon manufacturing, because even Chinese companies want to make a profit. There isn't just a bunch of companies out there who exist purely for the provision of overcapacity.
Well, the thing is that they're constantly optimizing it, and the fundamental technology of the Siemens process doesn't really change, but you can just make the machines more efficient in terms of losses or not breaking and things like that. So when I first started writing about this, the marginal cost of production in China, I think the lowest, I think it was $7 per kilogram. The price now is $7 per kilogram, but they probably have pushed down the cost to $5.50, something like that.
Hmm.
But you do need some profit margin. So,
yeah, agreed. Well, no, that is very good to know. As it is, that's capitalism at its finest, is it not? Like, I know Schumpeter would be very happy with that. Just continuous innovation towards avoiding being forced out of the market. But yeah, as you say, let's move on. That's enough on solar for now. So one of the stories that I wrote this week was on how a report from the European Federation for Transport and Environment is claiming that this year, 2024, we'll see 25% of Europe's EV sales having been manufactured within China. Now, this probably sounds a bit low to a lot of people, based on where electric vehicles are made primarily, but last year it was 19.5%, and I do believe that it's been historically lower, so this is a straight upwards trend. Effectively, the expectation is for this to continue increasing marginally. But there's a question of by how much, and the report looked into what level of tariffs are needed for price parity between Chinese-made EVs and European-made EVs. It found that a tariff of 25% would split, because it does depend on the vehicle type, but at least for mid-size sedans and SUVs, that 25% tariff would make EVs marginally more expensive. Whereas for compact SUVs and any larger vehicles like a pickup truck or such, which I know isn't strictly a European sort of desire, but it's for larger vehicles, then even a 25% tariff wouldn't bring Europe on cost parity with China. Now, most of this is down to battery manufacturing. I would argue a solid 15 to 20% of it is down to battery manufacturing, just because China is worlds ahead, and frankly, it's not out of Europe's league, it's playing a different sport when it comes to battery manufacturing. So it has the supply chains set up, it has the manufacturing all set up, it has significant overcapacity of certain cell technologies, primarily lithium iron phosphate. And Europe, in particular, isn't sorting out all of that at once. It's gotten significant interest in the cell capacity in cell manufacturing from incumbent manufacturers, from the South Korean manufacturers, and from some startups like Northvolt. But the raw material supply chain still isn't relocating over to China, and over from China. And the only reason it would is if Europe was paying a premium, which completely defeats the point in onshoring production anyways. The question of will Europe see a price competitive EV that is made from European materials by a European company in Europe is laughable. So the question then becomes, how does Europe compete? The answer is tariffs, but we've been kind of trying to bang the drum about this for a while, in that Europe doesn't have the geopolitical leeway, almost as it were, to start another fight. It's still kind of reeling from the effects of having to exclude Russian gas, increasing energy prices, which has made its industrial manufacturing utterly uncompetitive and requiring large subsidies. And now it's looking at increasing costs even further, but rather than through energy, it's through raw materials, which is almost entirely controlled by China.
So I actually would kind of like them to stop being so supine and try to protect an industry. At least in this case, the EVs, the industry already exists. Whereas with solar power, you'd have to exclude the Chinese while rebuilding from scratch, because you don't have a wafer segment or a cell segment.
Oh, no, you would need to exclude China and support EV manufacturing as well.
Whereas at least Europe apparently does have an EV manufacturing industry, which for solar it really doesn't, not on scale.
It does, but not at the scale that's needed.
Okay.
So the battery cell manufacturing is not enough domestically. It's almost entirely in Poland, weirdly enough, ran by a single factory by LG Energy Solutions. That's the majority of Europe's current battery manufacturing capacity. EVs, there's a bit more, but again, it's more about the conversion of existing facilities. Again, China has the low-cost manufacturing. So with how Tesla and with how early Western EV companies kind of started in the industry, start with the high-margin vehicles to get the early adopters in, and then you move downstream in the market. We're past the point of it being an early adopter market. It needs to be a mass consumption market now, because the scale we're talking about and the price level that we're talking about being attractive to most people, the people who would be early adopters already are. And so there needs to be a practicality reason for it, which needs low cost, and that needs significant manufacturing capacity. Because Europe's problem right now is that it is still very, very far behind in the kind of fundamentals of EV manufacturing. The VW group has already delayed its dedicated EV platform, which is a pretty major step to reducing the manufacturing costs of manufacturing an electric vehicle to 2029 or 2028, I don't remember. And because of that, it's having to license one from XPeng, a Chinese company that it does admittedly have a large investment stake in, but it's not good at all that Europe is still this far behind.
So just to be clear, when it says that 25% of EVs will come from China, that actually doesn't mean that the other 75% comes from the EU. It's mostly from the US, is it? Or what?
A significant chunk of them will still be manufactured in the EU. And so I am curious, I haven't read the full report, I'm curious as to their methodology of, if the battery is from China, are you saying this is from China? Because it functionally might as well be. But if it's importing batteries from China and then manufacturing them in the EU, is this class as EU made? I imagine it will be.
And I'm kind of curious about what the timeline is on EVs, because you look at other industries that the Chinese are taking over. They're already at 75% for wind, 90% for solar. They kind of took over the solar industry mostly already a decade ago. So why has it taken so long for EVs? I mean, isn't it raw material and energy dependent, which is where they're strong?
So the problem with this is that it's still very much a kind of a new industry, as it were. It's the technology is still significantly kind of developing. And so, especially with battery technology, we're seeing significant improvements year over year on fast charging capabilities, energy density, compatibility, weight reductions. There's still significant innovation to be had within the industry. And China is by far the leader within battery and EV manufacturing technologies because they've simply been doing it for longer. They've been supporting the EV and the battery industry since the early 2010s at the minimum. Whereas Western manufacturers have been seriously dragging their heel and trying to legislate to continue the life of ICE vehicles. The timeline of mass adoption is within this decade into the beginning of next for Europe. There is also the problem of not every region is going at the same pace as everyone else. North America is marginally behind Europe, and most other and lots of other economies are marginally behind America. Australia's picked up recently, but
so again, I'm not as familiar with all these numbers as I should be. But actually, when you look at only 25% of Europe's EVs are supplied from China, that doesn't necessarily mean, oh, China hasn't taken over yet. It just means, oh, the Chinese market is so big that they don't have many left to export, and Europe's market is small.
China's market's big enough, but they're only beginning to export more recently. So last year's numbers were based on a lot of kind of domestic manufacturing, a lot of domestic sales. It would have been vast majority European manufacturing, even if the vehicles themselves weren't actually that good. Whereas Chinese brands like BYD, like NIO, like XPeng are looking at expanding into Europe from this year onwards.
Oh, I see.
Lots of them opening facilities in 2024 and 2025 to be able to sell into these markets. This is worrying because these vehicles will be manufactured in China. They'll be using labor produced in China. They'll be using raw materials sourced from China and its supply chain partners. Europe doesn't benefit at all from these manufacturing industries shifting elsewhere, but it can't compete on either the product or the price because the EVs that are made in Europe by European companies right now, by and large, have Chinese batteries in them already. So they're paying a higher margin as opposed to having a vertically integrated system.
typically there's an assumption, which is historically correct, that the West has a technological edge over China. And this is one of the cases where it's flipped into China's favor.
Yeah, absolutely. There's no, I don't think there's any real level of defending that side of things in the battery industry. It's been the case for the last decade, I would say, in the battery industry. Wow. In electric vehicles, maybe just this decade.
Oh, I see, like but since 2020.
For batteries, since 2014, 2015 or so.
Hmm.
For EVs, 2020, I would say.
So is there a phenomenon like there is in solar where there's like three types of solar panels? There's ones where you just buy them from China, although there's ones where you make the module out of cells from China, or there's ones where you make the cells from wafers out of China. Is there a thing like that in EVs where China dominates, what, the battery segment more than the full assembly?
Well, so lots of the EV supply chain can just be repurposed from, you know, the internal combustion engine supply chain. Obviously, you don't need the gearbox or the engine, but you still need a vehicle body. So when it comes to things like aluminium, that's going to be sourced locally for things like the vehicle body or the drivetrain, that sort of thing. You're going to source the base metals wherever you originally sourced them from, and that's largely going to be from local producers, because the cost of transport is as high as it is. But when it comes to that sort of thing, I think as batteries are primarily sourced from China, because even if you import them, which is a significant additional cost because they don't really travel well, rather bulky things that you need to separate a lot of the time.
So because you don't want it all to catch fire, right?
Because of the transport risks. Yes and no. It's less of a risk nowadays, particularly with Chinese batteries that are lithium iron phosphate based.
So will Chinese battery manufacturing that serves the Europe market, will it be physically located in China, or will it be Chinese companies operating in Hungary and Poland and places like that?
That's the recent shift. So even if Europe wants to put tariffs on Chinese production, Chinese companies are investing significantly, particularly in Eastern Europe right now.
And it's exactly the same as First Solar complaining about the Chinese giants building factories in Texas and Florida and so on.
But at the same time, if Europe wants to put tariffs on Chinese companies instead, as opposed to Chinese production, then you're completely jeopardizing all of that investment.
Yeah.
So what does Europe do? You're both kind of jeopardizing that investment in the less industrially sound or the less industrially developed members of the bloc, which is going to antagonize them significantly in terms of actually voting out that investment. That's a really difficult geopolitical move to make, because China has total control over the supply chain. I write about this almost every week because it's a serious problem the EU has. Just, what does it do if it puts tariffs in place and we just say, okay, well, we're going to increase the tariffs on refined lithium exports, because they haven't even touched them. It's only so far targeted some very niche product categories and adjacently connected industries. So germanium and gallium, they're more relevant to the semiconductor industry. Natural graphite and synthetic graphite products were restricted recently, so companies have to apply for an export license. The full effect of that policy is still kind of yet to completely hit, but by and large, China has a lot more that it can do when it comes to raw material messing about with the supply chain to hurt Western interests, because the amount of time that it takes for us to reshore these supply chains is how long China has to weaponize its current total dominance of it. We can almost expect a ratcheting up of weaponization, just because China's going to want to make use of its kind of historical dominance in one way or another.
So we actually do expect Europe to be doing something, do we, on trade?
Well, yeah, exactly. So Europe has a EV tariff probe that's active and has found evidence of unjust subsidization. Yeah, we got the results for that about a couple of weeks ago, saying, yep, we have found evidence of direct and indirect funding from the Chinese government. We're now going to take it under consideration what exactly to do. And so that's why there's still maybe three possibilities or so of what Europe can do. But it's not, well, absolutely none of them are good, particularly for European consumers, because it means trying to alienate, it means alienating Chinese supply of electric vehicles, which are the cheapest and the best options by and large. So, well, or it means significantly increasing their cost to be in parity with European manufacturing, which takes the impetus off of European manufacturing to be as price competitive. So how you were mentioning with Chinese solar companies competing with one another for the marginal gains of very small efficiency, with very small efficiency boosts, we're not going to see that if tariffs are put in place in Europe. It'll be European companies competing with European companies to try to reduce costs, but they won't be competing against the best in class. It'll be a League Two match rather than a Premier League match, is effectively what I'm saying. So, yeah, that's enough rattling on for me. I think that's a good welcome back to the podcast. That's a long segment.
Caught up on most of the missing battery coverage from the past month or more.
Yep. All right, let's have a quick look at some of the work notices from this week's issue, see if there's anything interesting. Something that I found interesting is that this was a little bit of time ago now, but the US has backed two Australian listed rare earth products with up to $850 million. So Australian Strategic Materials and Meteoric Resources have two separate rare earth element extraction projects. One in Australia, the other in Brazil. And these are getting significant support from the US government due to its strategic nature in onshoring the supply chain and taking away that influence from China.
Cool. The sort of 98% rare earths figure or whatever it is, 98%.
Yes. Well, in China, the vast majority of industry extraction is from China, and the refining is almost entirely China.
So are these just mining projects and not the refining part? I mean, they're still significant if they are just the mining.
I'm not entirely certain. I believe this is mostly just mining so far. I think there might be, considering the numbers involved, there might be some integrated refining, but not too much.
Hmm. Oh, because if you refine it, then you don't, your transport costs are less. You're not moving around useless rock.
That, and you can internalize the margin.
Hmm, yes.
So people will pay a greater premium to not have to refine it themselves into magnets and such. If the US is investing in this, if it's primarily neodymium and praseodymium, and if that's the main things that they're looking for, then you just turn it into permanent magnets of the kind of the highest quality or the most in-demand product that you can, and then you sell it. But if it's some more obscure stuff as the main thing as a defense application, then it might be better to just sell the rare earth oxide and just export it over to the US. It depends. So I think for the Brazil project, it would make more sense to export the ore, because obviously it's a little bit closer than Australia in terms of the transport costs to be able to send it over to the US at relatively low cost. Whereas in Sydney, it might be better to do the refining in Australia and then export the finished products. But it's $850 million in subsidies. So with how the US has done subsidies in the past, that's probably a matched investment in the sense that the companies are putting forward some of its funding towards manufacturing facilities, particularly as these aren't US companies, where we have seen kind of loans underwriting the entire manufacturing cost of a project recently. And so that's not going to cover the entirety of it, I imagine. I'm not overly certain as to the size of these projects, but I will look it up for next week. Is there anything else that you found particularly interesting this week? There was an announcement this week from Sigma Lithium in Brazil, in that they're looking to add a second Yeah, it's a second lithium production line at its industrial plant, which will effectively double its output by the end of 2025. And so this is a bit odd, considering the lithium price environment that is pretty poor for recent standards, falling 80% year over year, obviously, well, and marginally more than that from its peak in November 2022. And so really, it's just a proof and some more companies seeing that as of right now, the main thing driving investment in the lithium market isn't the supply dynamic. It isn't the kind of current supply-demand balance, because sentiment is still broadly saying we do not have enough lithium. To have enough lithium, we need more mining projects. And should these be coming online from 2025 onwards to 2028 or so, there will be a good period of... It will be coming online as the supply imbalance begins to become problematic. Low lithium prices means low battery prices, or lower battery prices. Low battery prices means low EV prices. This should increase EV uptake marginally, because it should mean that the production costs of EVs lower, lowering ticket prices as companies compete with each other for kind of market share and for brand recognition in this new industry. And so a prolonged period of low prices, traditionally in most raw material markets, so such as nickel most recently, I would say, low prices utterly decimate investment. So with the nickel price collapsing to 16.5k, I believe it's at right now per ton, Glencore has abandoned its kind of flagship new Caledonian nickel project that it spent somewhere to the tune of $10 billion trying to bring up to production. And that's just because it was no longer it was never profitable, to be fair. But it's completely and utterly abandoned that because it doesn't see a long-term outlook. Whereas with lithium, the long-term outlook exists and is very, very strong, to the point where Sigma Lithium is spending $100 million USD, I want to say, in expanding its production capacity by 100%. But for the end of 2025, I don't think its timing is perfect there. We see the supply imbalance taking more of an effect from kind of mid-2026, maybe early 2026, depending on uptake.
Hmm.
But with high interest rates and such, economic growth problems, and really it just depends on how well Chinese EVs can penetrate into Western markets, because that will significantly drive adoption, because they're much lower cost. You're expanding the total kind of addressable market by allowing that. That's why subsidies and imposing tariffs on Chinese EVs is so important, because the effect just ripples throughout the value chain. I think I've rattled on enough. This is quite a long episode for only two people. So,
Anyone who was missing the battery coverage has been satisfied, I think, at this point.
Well, I hope that's a good return to form. Anyways, we will leave it there for now, and we will be back again with another episode next week, and maybe with an episode in between. But for now, we would like to thank you all for listening, and hope you tune in again next week. So thank you and goodbye.